Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center. I'm so happy to be with John Dougal on the political right.
Hey, great to be with you.
And on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. So glad you're with us.
Happy September. It's hard in a presidential election year not to fill the whole program up with presidential politics. Let's try and move through these quickly, but I wanted to get to John.
Is that coming up this year?
How many days are we now?
We're like almost 2 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to get, John, your reaction to the Kamala Harris-Tim Walz CNN interview, their first major interview. You mentioned off air I didn't
see this. I have been really busy, and we'll talk about why I was really busy in a little bit. But
yeah. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for
that I don't
either
have CNN?
Candidate? Well, for either candidate.
Either Shireen. Candidate. Okay.
Do people pay attention?
So there was all this criticism. Oh, she should sit down. She's got to sit down for a major interview. Those calls were largely coming from the right, but also from mainstream media who simply are living in a time that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, her time is better spent doing drive time radio in Milwaukee, doing local press and local news in Pennsylvania.
Paid media.
Social media. Yeah. The opportunity to actually reach the small segment of undecided voters in this election is not really well spent doing a sit down interview on a major news network anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say there's also something a little bit interesting about this. But she did have her vice presidential pick, Tim Walz, with her. Some criticism here, but this is actually also kind of standard. Typically, after the convention, the two candidates do sit down together for a joint interview. I think because this timeline is so compressed and everything feels so wild, this feels odd, but I think it was nice.
I found myself watching it from an interesting light because he's the number two, but he's sitting there with her. And I watch him on stage when they come out and he's the number two. And she actually has a pretty commanding presence from my perspective. I don't know if the two of you
in the interview on the stage.
She's expressive. She's articulate. She's attractive. She's knowledgeable. This is why I think she gets under Trump's skin. But I prefer the number two role in life for a whole variety of reasons. I like having my fingerprints on things, but not being the front.
Right.
And you've been an LG candidate.
Yes. Yeah, I have been an LG candidate.
That's a number two spot.
Making things happen in the legislature without the one necessarily with their name on the bill. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I just watched him from that perspective, and he handles himself well.
Yes.
Yeah. And he doesn't, you know, speak over her. He doesn't assume anything. He's just there to support.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that's hard for a number two. You gotta know your role. You got to play the role well. And it looks like he's playing that very well.
He was criticized. She was criticized in the irresponsible sort of doom scrolling world of social media for being a lapdog for her, like a
that's what a number two does.
let me
ask a couple questions. What does she say about the economy? What does she say about the border? What does she say about Israel? What does she say about Ukraine?
Oh, those are large, but you know, she went right to the middle class in talking about the economy, and then went through her policies that would help the middle class, whether it was, you know, helping with first buyer home buying assistance, whether it was helping with a child tax credit. I mean, she doubles down on middle class. She spoke to in a balanced way about Gaza and Israel, didn't you think, Shireen?
Yeah. You know, I think that we'll see in some ways a real continuation of what we're seeing from the Biden administration, which I have to say wouldn't.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it wouldn't be that far off of previous Republicans, to be quite frank. I don't think it's what we would get with a Trump administration, which would be, I think, a significant increase in chaos in the Middle East. And I think it was a very perhaps a bit more hawkish than I would like, but I would say a pretty centrist.
She was pushed by the interviewer very hard on changing her mind on fracking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the evidence? What motivated that? I thought she navigated that pretty well. And the border was asked directly about as well. So I think it was a strong interview.
Yeah.
She didn't misstep.
Now the question will be, will that be the interview and then she's moving on, or will there still be pushed for more? And I still want to know, are they going to debate?
Yeah.
Yes.
Either the presidential candidates or the vice presidential candidates.
So we will not be with you before. It's supposed to be September 10th, correct? So our next episode would come out after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious. I don't know. Like, send us your emails. Let us know if you think it's going to happen.
Mic's on or mic's off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shireen, let's hear you set this up. The former president, Donald Trump, he's waffling on abortion.
Yes.
He's expressing opposition to the Florida 6-week abortion ban, and then he's coming back and saying, actually, I'll support it.
Yep.
How would you set this up? I mean, the guy seems to like lick his finger and put it up in the air and feel where the wind's blowing.
That's exactly what he does. So I need listeners to follow me on this logic, if nothing else. Donald Trump is the person who put the conservative Supreme Court that we have, the Republicans on the Supreme Court, in place to overturn Roe. The chaos that we have in this country now, where half of the states really have very limited or total restrictions on abortion access, where people who are trying to have families are suffering dire consequences. The health consequences of this are extreme. And also the personal freedom choices of this are extreme. We live in a bifurcated society because of decisions that he made, and he has said repeatedly he is proud of that. If you look to Project 2025, that is just the beginning. We're talking about when you hear J.D. Vance say, oh, we're not for a ban, but we do believe in a national minimum standard. That's a ban. When you think about the things that they're saying on contraception, this is chaos for this country and people's ability to space out their families when they want them or get the health care that they need. So this is not a person who should be trusted on this issue. But I do think it's exactly pandering. It's exactly looking to the winds and seeing that most Americans would prefer that these decisions are made by pregnant people and their families and their faith, and the government should be out of it. So this is like, I think it's really disingenuous to hear him come out and talk about IVF. And basically what he's saying, and John, I'd be curious on your perspective on this, but what he's calling for is a government mandate to insurance providers to pay for IVF, or that the government will pay for it. So who is this appealing to on the Republican side?
I love this coming at you, John, from a fiscal responsibility point of view, because this is like
government perspective.
This is like Coca-Cola in the drinking fountains at elementary schools.
Yeah.
You know, like
did you run on that when you ran for class president?
Yes, I did. Only it was just red punch, but
oh, there you go. So one, I disagree with Shireen. I think abortion never should have been elevated at the federal level in 73 with Roe v. Wade and whatever Casey and so forth that came out of that. It really should have been down at the state level. And I would say that almost every American believes in some type of ban on abortion. Now, they may draw the line differently, whether it's 6 weeks, 16 weeks, 24 weeks, wherever it might be. But almost every single one of them agree on some type of a ban.
They rarely agree the government should make that decision for them.
Oh, most of them agree. There's a certain point at which government should step in, a certain point. I think the overwhelming majority agree late-term abortion just largely should not exist except for the life of the mother.
And I just have to put into people's ears that after 21 weeks, we're talking about a fraction, like less than 2% of abortions. And those are almost always in medical emergencies, which people widely agree should be decisions that are left to doctors and patients. So I just have to say the reality that you're living in is very different than the one that most Americans
live in. Well, like when Donald Trump talks about executing babies after they're born.
It doesn't happen.
Quite extreme.
Infanticide is illegal in every state.
So given that almost every American believes in some type of ban on abortion,
they don't.
It is. But when you look at IVF, I mean, I support IVF. I've had friends and family members who have benefited from the miracle of IVF to allow them to bear children. Okay. I do not think it's the role of government to be funding it, to be mandating on insurance companies, to be forcing the taxpayers to pay for it. I don't think that's the role of government. I think that individuals should be able to engage in that themselves.
All right. So now we have Jack Smith, which I think is a great name for a guy in his role. He's now amended the indictment of Trump.
And Jack Smith is who?
Well, he's the special counsel, special prosecutor,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But he's reworked it to now adjust to the Supreme Court ruling on immunity. John, you're a legal guy at this point. How do you read this?
Yes. So the Supreme Court came out and said there is a certain realm in which the president's actions, he has immunity from criminal prosecution. So Jack had to go through and had to strip some things out, some conversations that he had with the Justice Department saying, clearly, based on what the Supreme Court just said, this falls in there, the president's immune. So I'm going to strip that stuff out of there. I'm going to still leave in there the discussions he had with the vice president, because that falls into the maybe category based on what the Supreme Court said. And he's going to charge the Hill and see if he can make a case with that. Yeah. Now, my understanding is Jack Smith tends to have a tendency to push the envelope on some things. And if he really wants the general public on both sides of the aisle to really get behind him, I would suggest he really needs to stick on the firm ground. Mm-hmm. And clearly I have concerns with the classified document handling, serious concerns there. And I And I would caution him to not try and overreach, mm-hmm. potentially losing yeah. whatever else he might do and any credibility that might come with it.
Shireen, this will not go to trial before the November election, but it reminds us that how much the former president has on the line, because if he doesn't win,
yeah.
he not only doesn't win, but he gets all of these lawsuits and sentencing and he ages.
Yeah.
And he does not have a great runway ahead of him, particularly if he doesn't win.
No, he doesn't. And I just hope that people understand this is a grift and the grift continues. And a big part of it is to keep himself out of legal trouble.
Yeah. I don't want to rush this, and we're just down to a minute or so in this segment, but we've got to talk about the Arlington National Cemetery.
Yeah.
To set this up, you know, the Arlington National Cemetery filed a report after two Trump campaign aides verbally attacked and pushed an Arlington employee during a visit by Trump on Monday. Of course, this was a visit that was to go to a Utah family that lost their father, their son, their, you know,
loved one
in the really disaster of the pullout from Afghanistan. Wasn't it from a suicide bomber at the gate?
Yeah.
that this gentleman passed. But Governor Cox got caught up in this, Shireen.
Yeah, he did. And I'll say, for all the criticism that listeners have heard me level against our governor for many things that I find troubling or distasteful, he did the right thing here. There were some missteps along the way, it sounds like, apparently. At some point, the images were shared with his campaign. The campaign sent out a fundraising email, which is wholly inappropriate.
Yeah, you should not have a donate button on that.
With pictures taken at the cemetery.
With pictures taken at the cemetery. Those kinds of images used in that setting for political gain and fundraising is absolutely, I find it disgusting. I will also say what he did very shortly thereafter, which is something Trump and his team have not done.
Like hours later.
Is apologize and send out an email explicitly saying that he knew that that was wrong. I think that that was the right thing to do, would not have been to circulate those photos in the first place. But here we are. And I do think the right thing to do was to apologize for using these photos in this way.
Yeah. I love that you're giving our governor, you know, credit there, because that's how you should conduct yourself in public office.
Yep.
John, we'll give you just a couple seconds on this one.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, I think he needs to go back and look at the process, who took the pictures and how they ended up over with the campaign and so forth. But clearly, quickly, promptly admitting it was wrong, apologizing for it, promising it won't happen again was critical.
Any bets on whether the former president will issue an apology on this one? I think there's almost 100%. All right. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal, still here on the right.
And Natalie Gochner, I'm in the political center with my good friends, and we are talking about public issues affecting our state. And John, you've been making news as state auditor. You've had this very difficult assignment of verifying signatures or auditing the signature gathering.
That's something we volunteered to do, yes.
Okay. So this gets back for our listeners to, we'll go to the governor's race, where he got on the ballot through signature gathering, and his opponent, who's now running as a write-in candidate for governor, Phil Lyman, basically challenging the accuracy, the legitimacy of the signatures?
Whether some of those signatures even existed and so forth. And so, so
that would be a pretty risky thing for a sitting governor to have signatures that were, you know, fraudulent. I think that's a stretch.
Well, and there's an aspect, though, this interesting situation where there's certain things that you can look at if you're, you know, not one of the election workers. There's certain things you can look at and certain things you can't look at for those that choose protected status. They want to protect their voter registration information. And so we announced that we were going to do a limited review of control over and disclosure of protected information, as well as the signature validation process.
Can you just remind people, what is protected?
So you may, when you fill out your voter registration, check a box, say, I want my information protected, which means it's not provided to the general public, but it may be provided to certain government officials or campaigns or political parties.
Yes.
And I always recommend people check it, because otherwise people look at your information and then they reach out to you and send you things. And I just prefer to be under the...
And there's another category, which is if you are a victim of domestic abuse and other things like that, that has an even more protected status
right,
there.
Right, right.
But so the question was, did folks, and there was about 11,000 per each of the three candidates we looked at, did about 11,000 of those validated signatures for voters that requested their information be protected, did those signatures even exist? What was the validation process? Was it the same as everything else? So we specifically sampled out of there. We did a statistical sampling, a little over 370 signatures each per candidate, and looked at that. And so for the candidates, we noted about a what we call a 1% exception rate. For one campaign, we noted three signatures we took exception with, saying we did not think they truly had enough characteristics or features to say that was a match to what's on file. Another one.
We're looking at the signature and a driver's license image
of either what they signed for their driver's license or their voter registration form that's on file with the election office. And we're sitting there looking at a piece of paper versus what's on the screen saying, does that signature match that signature and for this person with this name and this address?
And it may not be that there was anything wrong. It could be just that they didn't sign it the same way. But
yeah. For example, for the Cox Henderson campaign, I looked at more than 500 signatures myself. I looked at all of them personally to say whether or not I thought.
No wonder you didn't watch the CNN debate.
Yeah, I was quite busy last week.
Now we know.
Doing this. And my team worked really hard, and we thought it was timely for this part of our limited review to get this out in a timely manner to say, here is what we saw. Mm-hmm. Statistically, here's our analysis. And given the exceptions, and I'll pick specifically for the Cox campaign, I noted four exceptions. Of that, I thought one signature was clearly fraudulent from my perspective. The other signatures that were around it that were also what I would call fraudulent had been rejected. They didn't match, not registered, whatever it might be. That one, for some reason, slipped through. And then there were three others that we looked and said, maybe, maybe not. I didn't think there were enough features to say it matched, but there wasn't anything to say it was fraudulent or it wasn't theirs. And so given that four out of 373, we then projected that exception rate onto the entire 28,000 sample and said that would equate to about 300 signatures we would take exception to. So then after that, we looked and said, okay, for those campaigns, for the Brown and Curtis campaign, they had gathered so many additional signatures. We just said, okay, statistically, we're fine. We're not going to look at those. On the Cox campaign, we had the election workers go through and do their validation process on the uncounted signatures that had been received before March 15th.
Before the deadline.
They did their process. Then we went through and sampled those. And of that secondary sample, we basically looked out of one out of every three. We determined there were about statistically 391 valid signatures in the uncounted category.
Yeah.
We didn't take any exception with those.
The system worked.
The system worked. And I do you have any way to estimate what this cost taxpayers?
It was me and my team for this week.
Yeah.
We also have the legislative auditor general in there. He has a much bigger team looking at, we have some overlap in what we're looking at and some disparity in what we were looking at.
And so this is a team of what?
For me, it was three of us.
Three of you. And then for them?
For them, I don't know their exact number, but it was a significant team.
Yeah. So I just encourage people to really think about when candidates, you know, insist on this kind of review, when we have numerous examples of really a strong level of veracity in our voting system, in the protections that are in place. And honestly, supermajority Republican control over nearly every county, not all, but many. I would just ask people to really question what is happening here. What kind of challenges to the truth or to our systems, you know, are being presented, and for what, who gains, right? Who gains from this? So thanks for the work.
You're welcome. We went through, there was a video that we did that was part of the training that all validators have to go through. And we did the exact same training and did that before we engaged in reviewing signatures. Wow. And I will note while anybody doesn't like to be audited, they don't like exceptions. You know, from our perspective, a 1% exception rate was quite low. The election officials we dealt with were very professional. They were very diligent. They did the additional work we requested without complaint.
Yep.
And I recognize that right now, last week, is the week that they're getting ready for general election. And so They had two audit teams simultaneously as they were trying to get ready for the general election, and they accommodated us. And so I appreciate that. And there is going to be other aspects of our audit that will come out later. But yeah. We wanted to get that piece out timely.
Well, I just want to ask Natalie, though, when you hear about this and you think about this coming from your party, what does it make you think about?
Well, a couple of things. I've never thought of this as the role of the state auditor. But I come from a perspective of state auditor being much more involved in financial audits and not so much performance audits and things like that. It's just a different orientation.
Yeah,
but when I was on Capitol Hill, it was different.
Who is the independent auditor for the state? That I'm independently elected. That is part of my job.
Yeah. And then just the other thing is, you know, I think it's time for Phil Lyman to, you know, let the process go and let Governor Cox, you know, represent Republicans in this election.
So. Yeah, I can understand that.
Hey, Shireen, I want to hear your comments on what you've seen with this proof of U.S. citizenship and what Senator Mike Lee is doing. He's trying to make sure that the bill that keeps government running has an attachment on it. The continuing resolution has an attachment on it that will require proof of U.S. citizenship before people can register to vote.
Yeah, so with this, we have some insider knowledge because we got to talk to a county clerk, but also even just the example that John just gave, we already have many controls in place where people's identity is verified when they register to vote in this country. I would say that this is performance. I think that these are honestly pretty reasonable questions that are usually answered at the local level. So I think this is Mike Lee continuing to act hysterical.
And John, where I come from on this one is if it gets us a continuing resolution, we don't cause economic harm by saying our federal government's going to shut down, I'll let it go.
And I'm one of those, I like single subject bills. I like them to stand alone,
for sure.
Voted up or down. I will also note, as a guy that always questions the amount of documentation that's out there, what happened to the concept of undocumented citizens? We used to live in a country where you could be born, you could live, and you did not have to have paperwork to prove who you were and so forth. And now, whether it's Social Security, driver's license, and so forth, we expect the government to give you ID on all sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you don't say undocumented aliens.
Yes.
I've never been comfortable with that.
The those that are not citizens should not be voting in our elections, but that's a whole different
matter. All right. I have to take both of you back to Super Tuesday, the presidential preference poll and the Republican caucuses that didn't go well, the big lines, the confusion, the lack of participation. And Senator Daniel Thatcher, what is he? He's one of the chairs of the Government Operations Interim Committee, if I'm getting that right.
Senate chair.
Senate chair. But in any case, they had a hearing all ready to go, hear the public comment, and it got swept under the covers and delayed. What do you know about that one, John?
I don't really know anything other than they had a special session. They were swamped and busy and shuffling things on their agendas. And so, you know, I heard rumblings that it was all teed up, ready to go.
Yeah.
And then
seems like bad timing for something like that.
Because of the emergency special session.
Yes, the non-emergency special session. Now, I will say this to me.
I put that in air quotes.
Yes, for those listening. So there is a, I think there's a really troubling pattern or starting to see a bit of a pattern of behavior here from the GOP. And I think the preference poll itself was a piece of this, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of having a primary, we had Democrats received a ballot in the mail. They can participate in caucus night as well, but you get to vote in the primary on, you know, as we vote in our general elections. Republicans did not get a chance to do that in this state. And then on top of that, there were many barriers to participation, including true chaos. I mean, the images, actually, what I remember is Utah County. Images out of Utah County where people were waiting.
Salt Lake County.
As well. But like you, it was very, I remember some of the images coming out of Utah County that were bad.
It's awful. I mean, I'm one of those that would have, well, I did support Nikki Haley. And I believe we would have been the second state to support her had we had a regular presidential primary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was close anyway with a presidential preference poll. And so the whole thing felt political to me
in a way that
I was uncomfortable.
And I always want the parties to be in charge of their nominating process. I want them to pay for their nominating process. I don't want the general taxpayers to pay for it. So going down that path, I think, is good, but it was poorly executed and did not turn out the way. And we always need to be looking to say, how does the party do it and how does it involve
Yeah.
In this case, Republicans actively in the process. So the overwhelming majority feel like they are part of the process and not disenfranchised.
And what they got was 1,700 negative comments from GOP voters that we don't get to hear.
Hey, we've got just a minute left in the program, but let's close out. Shereen, we'll go to you first. Representative Trevor Lee posted on a video on X that basically showed a Shiite Muslim celebration that didn't have any American flags in the background.
Yeah.
And, you know, had this troubling comment, you know, where he basically said, in the small town of Taylorsville, Utah, not a single American flag in sight.
I can't think of a way to make a group of people feel more targeted or excluded from a community of which they are a part of. I would also just ask Representative Lee if when he goes into wherever his place of faith is, does he find multiple American flags there? I think this is advancing a certain form of Islamophobia, of xenophobia that I find deeply disgusting.
John, it was viewed, this tweet, more than 5.4 million times. With additional context, more than 550 times and had more than 2,400 likes. So it was reposted 550 times and had more than 2,400 likes.
Yeah, and I'm going to say I see too many politicians walking around with flags on their lapels that I do not believe that they really believe and respect our country.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's easy to fly a flag. I want true
patriotism.
Americans who really believe and will do whatever it takes to stand up and protect our Constitution and our country.
That's a wrap. Thanks, everybody, for listening. The program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.